We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
In this hour of focus, we invite your questions on cameras and photography, something we do from time to time on the show. Our guest is Brian Johnson. He teaches photojournalism here at the U of I. He's currently the interim head of the Department of Journalism. And whatever questions you have can be about digital or film, can be about cameras, can be about technique, things that you can do to make a better picture, any and all of that. And certainly over time, people have had a specific thing they wanted to do with their camera. They'd say, look, here's what I'm trying to do. How could I do this? What kind of equipment do I need? How do I make that happen? And Brian has always done his best to help out. So 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Thanks for being here.
Sure. Once again. No, I'm happy to be here.
I think probably every time we do this, one of the things I think about in the beginning is how over the time we've been talking, how photography has changed, and how back in the day we started out saying, hey, what's up with these digital cameras? And now I don't know. That's just the thing. That's
right,
now what people
right.
are using.
Well, and even film cameras are still out there. Actually, a lot of the disposable film cameras that people buy, maybe if they're on vacation or at the zoo or something, those are still fairly popular. But the price of the digital cameras has come down so far that it's so accessible to people that really makes it, kind of a fun thing, because now even if you don't have a camera per se, you might have a cell phone that has a camera in it. Mm-hmm. You might have a cell phone that even has a video camera in it. So there are just so many people with cameras all over that you better watch out what you're doing when you're in public.
Yes, indeed.
And B, there's really no reason, not to have a camera. The cost threshold has gone down because, as I say, the cameras are cheaper. But also, you don't really need to spend money on processing. There's a little bit of money to buy a memory card. There's certainly money for your computer if you're going to store your images that way. But what I love about it is I can shoot, and I don't hesitate at all because I don't have to think, oh, do I have another roll of film? Do I have the money to get this processed and all the rest of it?
Yeah, just was visiting last week with a relative who was in town who had a relatively new digital camera. It was not very expensive. I think he said he spent maybe a little over $200. It was a Canon, and I know you're a big Canon guy. And I just said, well, how many pictures can you hold in the camera? And he said, well, of course, that depends on your card.
Right.
And also depends on how many megapixels, And then he proceeded to rattle off. He said, well, at 12 megapixels, this many pictures. And at 10, this many pictures.
Yeah.
And at 8, this many pictures. And we were up to, now I don't know what the quality of the image would be, but it was something like 80, at one point, at least 80 pictures. The camera would hold that pictures.
Oh, easily, yeah. And actually, that's something I think that would be really excellent for us to talk about is that I recommend to people that they shoot with their camera set to the highest quality setting. And here's the reason. Sometimes people set their cameras down thinking, oh my gosh, I could get, 50,000 pictures on this card. Yeah. But the problem is the pictures are only good at about 2 inches by 3 inches and only if you look at them on a computer screen. They're not, they're so low in resolution, you really can't do anything with them. If you shoot at the highest resolution, that gives you the opportunity to comfortably crop into them, to enlarge them, to, quite an enormous size. So it's really worth it just to keep the camera in the highest quality setting. I think it started when memory cards were expensive and to get, a 1 gigabyte card was, $100. Well, now a 1 gigabyte card you can pick up on sale sometimes for like $5. So there's really no reason to shoot at that lowest resolution.
Yeah. Just the other day I was looking at a recent issue of Consumer Reports, and there, some of their recommendations about cameras.
Sure.
And one of the things that, you know, say there was a particular group of cameras and that there, if you just looked at megapixels, it was actually fairly close. I mean,
right.
there was one, there was a couple that would do 10 and there was one that would do 12.
Right.
And the one that would do 12 also did have some other features that you might want.
Right.
But one of the things I was thinking was, well, really, how much difference is there between a 10 megapixel shot and a 12?
Right. Well, and something we talked about the last time I was on was it's not just what the megapixel count is, but the size of the sensor itself.
Right. Right.
'Cause you can cram in, you know, 12 million dots, 12 million little image sensors on a chip that's, you know, probably smaller than your little fingernail. But think about that. That's a lot of image capturing surface over a really tiny area. So if you had a 12-megapixel camera that had an itty-bitty sensor and a 12-megapixel camera that had a sensor that was larger, the one with the larger sensor would give you the better picture. It has lower noise, you know, or the kind of speckly color look that some people might recognize. And it'll also be sharper. The colors will be purer. So the manufacturers finally, I think, are at the point where they're realizing, okay, you know, once you're up around, you know, really even at 8 megapixels, even at 6 megapixels, you really have enough for the average user. Once you get up around 12, okay, but I think what would be better is if they started to make the chips larger.
Yeah.
Well, they make the larger chips, and the problem is to make the cameras really small and have, you know, some sort of zoom range that's respectable, it helps them to have the sensor be really small. So it's really that kind of trade-off.
Yeah.
I carry around a camera that has, you know, a smaller sensor than I'd like, but I have it with me. So if I see something, I can shoot it. It doesn't do any good to have a wonderful camera if it's sitting at home or sitting in your car or in your office where you don't have it with you when you see something that you want to shoot.
Yeah. And I guess I do continue to be impressed with the quality of the pictures that you can get with some of these cameras that literally are pockets. You can
put it
in your shirt pocket.
Right, right. And they're even really smaller than a deck of cards. I mean, they're thin, they're small.
Yeah.
And on top of that, most of them shoot video. And that was something that we used to talk about earlier. Well, you know, the video quality is not very good. Well, really, with a lot of these cameras now, the video quality is every bit as good as it might be if you bought a standalone video camera.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Brian Johnson. He's a professor of journalism at the U of I. He's a photojournalist, has been with us here on the program a lot of times over the years talking about cameras and photography. And if you have questions, call us, 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You know, something else that I noticed, and again looking at the consumer reports, one of the things that they had there as a, I guess it was a feature they must have thought was important.
Right.
Was, and I think that I understand this right, is how between the time that you push the button,
right, the
and
shutter
it actually
lag
takes the picture, mm-hmm, how long is it, and then how long do you have to wait between the first picture, mm-hmm, and the second?
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that can be really an issue, especially in the old days. It was a huge issue. Now it's not quite as much of an issue. Now I've noticed that the issue isn't so much the lag between when you press the shutter button and it takes the picture, but on the back end,
yeah,
when it's trying to process that image before you can take the next one. So, you know, tied in with that, and I think something that's really difficult to quantify and why they don't always publicize this fact is you need to go and look at the camera and see how the menu structure is set up. Because if you're going to adjust any of the settings, so if you want to use the camera in a manual mode, or if you want to manually focus, or if you want to go in a macro mode, or, you know, set the white balance, anything, how the camera is set up can make a tremendous difference on how willing you'll be to go and adjust those things. Most cameras have a green mode or a simple mode, an auto mode, where you don't have to do anything. But once you start taking pictures for a little while, you'll want to have a little bit more control. Some cameras have a menu structure that makes sense and is easily to be understood. Some cameras, it's basically the software that runs the camera. It's so confusing for you to navigate through to make various settings that you just don't.
Well, one of the things that is a difference among cameras is that some of them do have manual settings and some don't.
Right.
And so I suppose some people would say, particularly if mostly what they think that they're going to be doing is just point and shoot, they're going to say, well, do I care if this has a manual?
Absolutely. Mode? You know, and some of the cameras, what they've done is rather than having a switch or a button on the outside that's dedicated to, for instance, manual or the different settings, what they'll do is they'll have an auto setting and then they'll have sometimes what's called a scene setting. And built in, again, to the software on the camera, they'll have a fireworks mode, they'll have a beach mode, they'll have a snow mode. And those are good modes to have if you remember to use them or if you think about it. Honestly, though, David, you're exactly right that the automatic modes on most of these cameras are so good that for most people, they really don't, you know, if they're just interested in pointing and shooting, they won't ever really need to go into any of those settings. That's actually one of the neat things with all these new cameras is that they have so much computing power built in that the number of pictures that don't turn out really isn't that great anymore. And even if they don't turn out, it's not like you've wasted a piece of film or you have to pay for a print that wasn't any good.
Again, our questions here are welcome. You want to call in and talk about cameras, photography. Maybe you're thinking about buying a digital camera and you're just kind of not sure what to look at or what to think about. Or it could be somebody that's listening that's a real serious hobbyist or uses the camera in their work. Here's an opportunity to get some advice, ask some questions. 333-9455 and toll free, 800-222-9455. One of the things, I think probably we must have talked about this before, that people, if they had a camera that had some, was going to set the exposure.
Sure.
The camera then is going to look at the scene that it's presented with and it's going to have to make a decision.
Yes.
And if there are things in this scene that some things that are bright and some things that are dark. So now the question is, okay, how do you help the camera do the best job at figuring out what the exposure should be? Now, is that any easier now with digital cameras?
It is actually, you know, as the cameras have gotten more advanced and the technology has become more ubiquitous, the number of sensors that they have looking at the picture and saying, well, this is really bright up here, this is really dark down here, this is kind of a medium area. And then they've essentially engineered intelligence into the camera saying, well, you know, this circumstance probably means that the situation is, you know, someone, you know, doing a landscape with a bright sky behind them. So it gives you an exposure for that setting. The other thing that some of the manufacturers have done, they have what Canon calls intelligent contrast, and I know the other manufacturers have it too, where if some part of it is really dark and some part of it's really bright, it actually tries to mitigate that by evening out the contrast in the scene so that it's not, you know, totally bright and totally dark, that it helps save some of those, you know, darker areas or some of those lighter areas from not having any image data at all.
Okay. Here's a caller, someone in Urbana. Let us talk with him. Line one. Hello.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just recently purchased a digital SLR camera, and I bought a Pentax because the Pentax can take any lens that Pentax has made in the last, I don't know how many decades. And I had previously had a film version of the Pentax 35mm camera. So I'm able to attach the telecommunication lens to the camera, but not take pictures with the lens. And I assume that's because there's some sort of setting that I need to modify. I've not been able to figure that out or find online what it is, and I'm wondering if you could help.
You know, what happens in those circumstances, because Nikon has always advertised that, too, as a feature you can use, you know, lenses from all the way back. But what happens is that the newer lenses have basically little computer chips in them so that the lens can communicate with the camera body itself. I'm going to guess that there's probably in the menu structure, there's probably a setting for that type of lens, you know, because it's basically you're going to use it in a manual mode. So that's the kind of thing that I would look for. See if there's some sort of, if there's a setting in the menu structure of the camera. And then I might suggest you try to shoot with the camera in just the manual mode itself and see if it lets you do anything in that mode. Have you?
Yeah, I've set it to all the manual modes, and I'm unable to get any response. So perhaps there is something in the menu settings that I'm missing.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that's the only thing that I could think of. And, you know, and it could be that even though they say that all the lenses fit, maybe there are some that are incompatible for various reasons. So if there's not a setting, I'd also look to see if there's a list of compatible lenses, because even though they say all of them will fit, it doesn't mean that all of them will necessarily work up to, you know, up to the specifications that you're looking for.
Right. Understood. Okay. I'll take a look through the menu, and if not, check and see if I can find a list of incompatibles.
Yeah, great.
All right. Thanks for the call. Again, other questions? 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The kind of camera that the listener is talking about, the single lens reflex.
Yes.
Has for a long time been the sort of at the high end of cameras. And the thing about this camera is that when you look in the viewfinder, you're looking through the lens. You're seeing what the camera sees.
Well, more or less.
Because
we should talk about this. It's a really good question to ask. What's interesting is that really just about every single digital camera today, it's not a single lens reflex camera, but it is a single lens viewing system, really. Because if you're looking at the little LCD screen on the back, you're seeing what the camera sees. Mm-hmm. And even better than SLR camera is that you're actually seeing the exposure that the camera's going to set. So in some ways, even the cheapest, you know, little digital camera can give you even a better idea of what the picture's going to look like than the higher-end ones where it's just an optical system.
Yeah. That's what I guess I was wondering, though, if how different it is when you're looking, essentially, it's like looking at a little TV screen when you see the picture. How different that is from the point where you were, say, if you had an SLR camera, you were looking into the camera and looking through.
Right, and you'd have a higher quality image because you're looking through an optical system. Here's the thing, that since the camera is doing so much for you, including the focusing, it's not quite as critical anymore that you see the fine details that you'd see. So that's one part. The other part is that they're making the LCD screen on the back, and even if you have an electronic viewfinder where there's like a little TV inside, they're making those higher resolution, so that's helping. But the key thing is really is that you're not doing quite as much focusing, and you can see well enough to get the composition.
Yeah, okay. We have another caller. We'll get to them in just a second. Right now, stepping into the studio here is our producer, one of our producers, Martha Deal. We're going to take a moment here to, again, ask for people for their support. Here, we've taken a couple of days to do this, and, you know, over time, one of the things that we're actually really happy about is that we have shortened our pledge drives. We spend less time, fewer days and less time on the air doing it because we want to bring you the programs, and that's what you want too. But I hope that people who listen understand that it's very important for us from time to time actually to sit here in front of the microphones and directly ask for support. That's important particularly to invite people in who have not supported us in the past. So that's really why we're doing it. And also I think it's good to remind listeners just how important their support is. So this is one of the times we're doing it. This is a listener-supported station, and this is our fall membership campaign. And we are here to do everything that we can to make sure that the programs that are important to you today are here tomorrow. And you can help that make that possible by making a financial contribution and calling in with a pledge. Here's the number, 217-244-9455.
And we want to thank all of you who've called in today, 91 of you, for pledging $12,041. You can also point your browser to willpledge.org to make your contribution, or there are some of you out there who say, can I just mail you a check? Please, we would feel very grateful. It can be $40, which is our regular membership, $52, which is a dollar a week. $75 gets you our member benefit, two member benefit cards. And one of the things this year is I understand there are coupons online that you can get when you get a member benefit card. And I should say one is available at the $40 level. And also, you know, whether it's a dollar or $1,000 that you send in to us, it will be used to pay the costs of providing you great programming every day. Last hour I talked about Steve Cohen talking to First Source people. We have a First Source person right here in Brian Johnson, and I think it's really unique that you can call in and ask an expert. You don't have to go through Steve Cohen, which was nice, which was good, but you could call, you know, ask Brian right there. So pick up the phone, go to your computer, write us a check, 217-244-9455 or willpledge.org.
And what you're doing is you're really saying, yes, no, you know, not only do I think WYLL is good and think that the programs are good, but I understand that I'm helping to pay the bills and, you know, just a part of it. And that's really all we're asking, is that if we get as many different people as possible to pay just a part, just do a little bit, we'd be in great shape. So whatever you feel that you can afford, if you're a frequent or constant listener to the station, in our house it's almost always on. Sometimes we have to say, let's actually have a little quiet. If you're one of those people, and if the station is a big part of your life, we hope that you will just pay a little bit of the cost of keeping the programs on the air. Real easy. You can call us, 217-244-9455, or again, you can do it online. Go to willpledge.org, and we thank you very much. Our guest this morning, Brian Johnson, he's professor of journalism here at the U of I. He teaches photojournalism. He's also currently serving as the interim head of the Department of Journalism and has been taking pictures for a long time, has been teaching people to take pictures for a long time, and has been with us, a guest, for a long time. Has been stopping by here to talk about photography. It's always fun, and we get a lot of questions. So if you want to call in, talk about taking pictures, cameras, film, digital, any and all of that, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller, Champagne, line one. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
This is a bit of a recidivist question. I recently bought a 10-meg digital camera, and all these digital cameras, the default mode is color. Probably all the great photographers and masterworks of photography have always been done in black and white because the ability to control tone and color and shape, Rudolf Arnheim has explained all this brilliantly. Is it possible using a color digital camera to shoot thinking in terms of classic black and white photography? And how does one go about getting digital photography in black and white?
Sure. Well, almost all the cameras have some sort of my color setting where you can, sometimes you can set it up for low saturation, sometimes you can set it up for shooting sepia toned images, sometimes you can set it up for just shooting straight black and white. Here's what I recommend to people though, go ahead and shoot in color, but then when you're working with the image on your computer, that's really an opportune time to flip it into grayscale mode. You know, if you have the image in color, you can do anything that at all that you want with it. If you shoot it in black and white, it's in black and white forever.
Okay.
So I like actually shooting in color and, you know, then doing any sort of image adjustment when I'm working in Photoshop or Aperture or whatever program that I'm using. Now, having said that, if someone's just learning to shoot in black and white, there might be some advantage to shoot in black and white because then right after they shoot the picture, they can see what it's going to look like. So shooting in black and white, you need to be, I almost don't want to say more concerned about lighting, but lighting definitely has, I think, a greater impact on the way people read the photograph. So it could be that someone wants to shoot in black and white just as a way to learn the tonality, look at the lighting, and not be distracted by the color. So 90% of the time, I'd still advise shooting in color, working with it in black and white once you get to the computer. But if it's something where you're learning, you want to experiment with, it is actually very interesting to shoot something, but then see it in black and white.
Okay, that's sounds exactly what I wanted to hear. Thanks very much.
All right.
Great.
Thank you.
And, you know, David, tied in with that, some of the printer manufacturers now have special ink packs just for printing grayscale images or black and white. So instead of having, you know, cyan, magenta, yellow, and black, and some combination of that, they'll have black, dark gray, sort of dark gray, medium gray, you know, so they might have, you know, six or more inks that are just basically, you know, shades of black, yeah, so that you can really extend the range of that print.
And you would get a better, it would be a better looking print that
It'll
way?
Be a better looking black and white image if you do that, yeah, because it just, you know, greatly extends the tonal range that's capable with a printer. The inkjet printers that are out there really are pretty fantastic, and there's a lot you can do with your image, you know, from the computer to the printer, and that's just one of the things you can think about doing.
Okay. Next caller is in Sullivan on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Yeah, I've got a question. I've got an old camera my folks had, and it's the old metal tool. And I've tried to have it developed, but there is no place that will develop it. Do you have any idea where a person can get that? It's probably the film and the camera's probably 40 years old or more.
Right. I don't deal with film that much anymore. When I have a situation like this, though, not to sound like escaping the question, but I go online and do a Google search to see, you know, how many places are still out there. There are still places across the country that will process film. They will take in old film like this with the, I guess, warning on their part that they don't guarantee that it's going to work out, because they don't have any idea, you know, over the last 40 years, has the film been up in an attic and really hot, you know, moist conditions or whatever. But there are places that are out there that are basically specialist places that still do film, and their specialty is doing some of this older film.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Very good. On to Kankakee, line number two. Hello.
Hi there.
Mm-hmm.
I'd appreciate a recommendation for a software program to just manage and store my photography. The manufacturer abandoned the last one I had.
Yeah, that's always tough. There's certainly nothing wrong. There's no way you can go wrong if you use an Adobe product, because Adobe's, you know, one of the strongest software companies out there right now. They're well used and mostly well loved by most professionals out there. Adobe has a program called Lightroom, and they also just went online with, I don't know if they're still calling it Photoshop. They had Photoshop Elements, which was their kind of low end. And I don't know if they call it like Photoshop.com, but they actually have kind of a free online service. So that's another way you can go. You can actually store your pictures on one of these online sources. So there's sites like Flickr, and they'll store your pictures on their servers. But the problem is, what happens if they go out of business?
Sure.
You know, then unless you've stored a backup of your images on your home computer, you're out of luck, which is why just saving them on the home computer is probably a really great idea. But I, you know, honestly, Adobe makes some really great products, and I would, you know, I would stick with them because I think they're going to be around for a while. And I know exactly what you mean about a company, you know, dropping a software product that you've used. It's always the risk. A lot of times, you know, there are independent companies that make some really great software. Sometimes there's some free software that's also used, but you know, it's just always a little bit, you know, more tenuous. I think one thing about it is that thinking about the file format that you're saving your image in, I think is probably also part of the consideration that, you know, as you save an image on your local hard drive, you have to remember to migrate that information to whatever new computer that you get. Where that's getting easier for us, though, is that a 1 terabyte hard drive you can buy for $100 now. and it stores ridiculous amounts of data. The thing is, though, you want to buy 2 1-terabyte drives because then you can have one for the data and one as your backup. And that's probably the best way to do it. I guess there's also a little bit of a question, you know, what do you want to do with the images? Do you really want to catalog them some way, or are you just wanting to store them on your machine?
Pretty much just organize a little bit and store them. I rarely do anything in the range of altering or fixing anything.
Sure, sure.
Auto fix, it's about as complicated as I get.
Right, right. Well, I would probably recommend Adobe Lightroom software then. I mean, that, you know, it's a robust package and it can, you know, give you some good flexibility. But as I say, there are, you know, I know Adobe, I know Microsoft, I know Apple, they have some lower-end packages. Apple has iPhoto that really is pretty amazing. You know, Microsoft has some products. So, you know, sticking with the major brands like that, you know, you certainly can't go wrong with that.
Sounds good. Thanks very much.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm sure lots and lots of people have in their home somewhere, in a shoebox,
no,
in a drawer.
No, don't.
In a closet.
I don't want to think about it.
You know, old photos. And not, I mean, not only some that are really valuable and important, but just, you know, snaps.
Yeah, every day.
You know, everyday snaps. And what's, I guess, always amazing to me is that particularly black and white photos, maybe not so much about early color, but black and white photos can be very old and still look quite good.
Oh, they can be amazing, and they can hang in
there. And if you
take
care of them, store them properly, they can have a very long life. And I guess what I'm coming around to, again, is this idea, you know, wondering, people are going to wonder, my digital photos, you know, will I still be able to, you know, 50 years from now,
right.
80 years from
right.
now, 100
right.
years from now, will I still be able to, or will somebody still be able to look at these pictures?
Well, you can just hold your hard drive up to the light and let them
press it up to your forehead.
Yeah, right.
We'll have a link.
We can do a Vulcan mind meld.
Exactly.
With it. Well, but let's talk about that, though. Let's say that you have negatives from, you know, 1963. What are you going to do? Are you going to hold the negatives up to the light to see the image? When those pictures fade, are you going to be able to see what's there? Are you going to lose them? Are you going to be able to find them when you want them? Because they're not really cataloged. So actually, digital images can maintain their quality. But as we said, you know, you need to keep moving that data forward. What's been so fantastic, though, as I was saying, is that not only has hard drive storage space become so inexpensive, but the speed at which the computers are operating let you transfer massive amounts of data reasonably quickly. Mm-hmm. So I find myself, though, being cheap and saying, I don't want to spend that $100 for that backup disk. And all of a sudden I think, you know, you're an idiot. Because, you know, like last night in my neighborhood, we had a power outage. I have my computers protected by a battery backup, so at 4 in the morning, I was able to go down and I was able to turn on the computer so that I could turn it off safely. So there are things like that you can do, you know, spend, you know, $50, $80, $100 on a battery backup so that your machine doesn't, you know, go clunk and all of a sudden turn off. You know, really spending that $100 on an external hard drive so you can back up your data. Because what's the alternative? Well, the alternative is losing, you know, 18 years, you know, worth of photos, or spending several hundred, if not thousands of dollars, trying to recover that data from a crashed hard drive. So, yeah. And let's add one more little snippet there. Maybe even buy 2 backup drives, because then what you can do is, you know, take one of your hard drives over to a neighbor's house or a relative's house. So if your house burns down, you know, or backing it up with one of the online services, you know.
That's, I guess it you know, you have to ask yourself, how, you know, how much does it mean to me? How is it, how important
right.
is it? And how unhappy would I be if it was lost?
I think that's almost the better question. How unhappy would I be if it's lost? Because when we ask ourselves, how much is it worth? We're like, nothing's going to happen. You know, it's going to be okay. My, you know, I've never I had that one computer crash in 94, but, but it only takes that one time for it to go down that really leaves you out of luck.
Yeah, all right. Let's talk with some more folks. Cell phone, here, line one. Hello.
Hi. I have kind of a silly question. I don't know very much about photography, but lately I've been seeing a lot of really nice pictures that some of my friends have taken with a real focus on the foreground subject and very, very blurry backgrounds.
Right.
And I haven't been able to replicate that with my camera. And I was wondering, you know, how do you produce that kind of an image?
Right. You know, and this is actually one of the things that we give up a little bit with the smaller digital cameras, because they tend to have such great depth of field that it is difficult to replicate that shallow depth of field look. So the way you can do it, depending upon which camera you have, one thing, zoom in as close as you can on your subject. Then two, have the background and back of your subject be as far away as possible. So the closer you are to your subject, the closer, the greater the zoom is on the person, and then the further away the background is from the person. Those are all things that'll help get that effect. Then if you can, if your camera has a mode where you can set the aperture, usually it's listed as an AV mode or an A mode. That stands for aperture value or aperture. Then you want to set your aperture to the smallest number. The smallest number actually gives you the largest size lens opening. So if your camera has like an F4 or if it even goes to 2.8, you know, the wider that can be or the smaller that number is, the lower the depth of field will be and the more it will give you that effect.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. Now, why did they do that? Why did they make it this small?
You know,
what did they do?
Yeah, well, part of it is because the cameras are so small, the sensors are so small, that the lenses, you know, just the focal length of the lenses for that little chip give you that great depth of field. Part of it is, too, is how they've worked the shutter speed and the aperture all to the same mechanism. This is something that I've found really probably one of the greatest losses that I've noticed with some of the lower-end cameras is that your range of apertures is incredibly small. You might only have F4, F5.6, and F8, and that's it.
Hmm. Okay. Let's see. We have about maybe 10 minutes, a little bit less, in this hour of Focus 580 with Brian Johnson. He teaches photojournalism here at the U of I. He's the interim head of the Department of Journalism, and every once in a while is here, and we talk about photography. Questions welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next up, Champagne, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question that's leaning away from the technical aspects of photography, and I'm just wondering if you could take a few minutes to talk about the current state of photojournalism and how newspapers publishing their works now on the World Wide Web, how is that affecting photojournalism, if it's affecting it at all? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks very much.
Okay.
Okay, great. Well, that was actually my wife calling. I could recognize her voice anywhere. But she called in the last time that we were talking, and she asked a really great question, and this is a really great question, too. It's interesting when you describe me as teaching photojournalism, because that's true. But what's interesting is that, in a way, photojournalism has become multimedia, so that any photojournalist now, you're not just shooting images. You're shooting video. You're recording audio. You're doing everything. So really, the classic just strict photojournalist that works for a news organization almost doesn't exist, because the skill set now has expanded to include video and audio and putting them together in audio slideshows and things like that. One other interesting aspect of this, just yesterday I was reading a story about how California has passed an anti-paparazzi law. So the paparazzi are the people that take the pictures of stars. And they've made it illegal for anyone to take a picture of a star in a family situation and then sell that picture to a publication. Well, what does that do for the journalist? You know, all of a sudden now you're out. You might not be the paparazzi shooting for, you know, one of the fan websites or one of the Embarrass the Stars websites. You're trying to do legitimate work. Maybe someone has been embezzling. You know, maybe someone is running out on a child support judgment. You know, maybe there was a domestic incident. But, you know, just because they have their kids with them, all of a sudden now you're breaking the law because you've taken their picture. It's a real, you know, kind of tenuous situation. So as photojournalism has moved forward, and because it's so ubiquitous with everyone having a camera, it's meant that photojournalism's moving in this multimedia area. But now there's so many people out there with a camera that it's really kind of a wonderful thing for the visual reportage. But for the photojournalist, then, it's like still trying to fight and make editors realize that quality still matters, that if you have a picture that's the only picture of an event, you'll take it no matter what the quality is. Mm-hmm. But if you have two pictures, one where there's higher quality, you know, we're still going to go to the higher quality image.
Okay. That's a good question. We're kind of short on time. We have some other callers. Maybe if we had time, there were some things we could come back to. But I want to try at least to get the callers that we have. And they're both on cell phones. So we'll go next to line three right here. Hello.
Hi. I have started taking photographs about in the 1940s. I'm in my 80s now, and I have 35 millimeter Kodachrome slides. I have 2.25 inch square color slides. I have some old black and white. You know, I have a digital camera now. I'd like to put all of that onto disk and have it stored on my computer and organize it. I wanted to do this for about 10 years, but I never get around to it. What advice do you have me? I mean, I'm willing to pay someone to do this. Should I have it all put on a disk, or should I sort the pictures first by hand and then just give those to you? How should I do it?
I think that's a really great question. So, yes, hire someone to do it. There are companies out there that'll do this for you. You know, one other option would be to, you know, buy a scanner. And if there's, you know, maybe a high school kid, a college student out there that would do it for you, that might be an option. Although hire a professional to do it, you're going to get better quality. But moving on to the other part of the question, should I edit first and just have the one scanned that I think are the best, or should I have it all scanned? Well, if you can afford it, I would have everything scanned, because so often you don't know what's going to make a picture important. So I think about pictures of President Clinton with Monica Lewinsky in a receiving line, you know, and honestly, you know, pictures that you wouldn't have thought about. But all of a sudden it's like, oh, my God, you know, I've got to find that. So you go looking through and you find that picture. You know, who knows if, you know, somewhere in one of the backgrounds of one of the pictures, something becomes important, or maybe someone you have a picture of, all of a sudden, you know, boom, they're really there in the forefront. It'd be great to have that picture. So I hate to have people not scan everything, but if it's a matter of either doing it because you can afford it or not doing it, I would say, yeah, go ahead and do the edit and then have what you can afford scanned in.
Thank you very much.
All right, very good. Let's go on to somebody else. This is also a cell phone caller here, line one. Hello.
Hi. My question kind of ties into the previous callers. I'm interested in scanning a bunch of old black and white film I have. Most of it is 35 millimeter, but there, you know, is some 2.25 and then a couple of other formats as well. Is there a website I can go to that compares scanner specs and, you know, so I can, you know, determine, you know, what best suits my needs? I, you know, kind of stumble around on the internet, but I'm, you know, 3 times slower than the average there.
Sure.
And yeah, so and I was wondering to, you know, can I get away with using a flatbed scan, or would a like a film scan be better?
Sure.
And also, do you know of a resource I could go to brush up on the ins and outs of using infrared film? I'm assuming it still exists somewhere in the world. You know, because it seems like you had to use a
right special processing. Know, yeah, right.
You know, all that. So,
yeah.
You know, if you can just point me to a couple of websites, you know, so I'd really appreciate that.
Sure, sure. I honestly always just do a search because I'm always amazed. You know, there are some sites that I go to. There's, for in the professional realm, there's robgalbraith.com. He looks at most of the professional cameras. There's one that's called DP Review that I go to. But honestly, I almost always do a search because I'm amazed at the number of sites that come up that I had no idea existed. Frequently, what surprises me is that there are sites that come up where all they do is look at scanners and evaluate scanners. Some only look at point-and-shoot cameras. Mm-hmm. So honestly, I would do that. Now, as far as the question of flatbed or film scanners,
mm-hmm.
A film scanner in general is going to be better, but with the range of content that you have, I noticed, for instance, that Epson just came out with a fairly new flatbed scanner that has a transparency adapter on it so you can scan in negatives and slides.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be a really good place to start doing that. And then, you know, if there are those few gems that, you know, are your favorite images, maybe those you could send in and have really a high quality scan done.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Thanks.
Sure.
All right. Thank you. Anything you wanted to...
Well, I was just going to think about the infrared issue. You know, again, that's a great, you know, search to do on the net because there are people that are still passionate about infrared, and there are ways to do it with some digital cameras where they sort of, you know, some of them they're modifying the camera, some it's some settings that they're putting in. But there are ways to do that because the imaging sensors on the digital cameras do record the infrared in a way that the human eye doesn't.
Okay, we're trying to get real quick one more. Monticello, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I'm recently graduated to digital from black and white film darkroom back in the 70s. I bought a Rebel XTI EOS camera.
Right.
Came with a 18-55 lens on it. I photograph camera or cabinet work that I do, and also furniture work in a room where I need to get away, but can't. You know.
Right.
It's close quarter.
Right.
And also, I shoot a lot of macro nature, and I'm looking for an all-purpose lens, and some of the magazines advertise some Tamrons and Sigma and even Canon lenses, which are wildly pricey. Any suggestions on lenses?
Well, I had a philosophy that if there's going to be a problem with my image, I wanted it to be my fault rather than my equipment's fault. But having said that, you know, really some of the Sigma and Tamron lenses can be actually very good, even though they are pricey, but they might still be less than, you know, like the Canon branded lens. But honestly, when it comes to lenses, it actually, that's one area where you usually do get what you pay for, and it is worthwhile spending the money on one really good lens, like you say, that will do multi-purpose for you, and then, you know, just not buy groceries for a week.
Well, I'm going to have to jump in here. I hope that helps, and we have one person we can't take. I'm really sorry, but we're here at the end of the time. All we can say is I'm sure if on another day we call Brian and ask him to come over, he'd say yes.
I've always been
really generous with his time.
Great to be here.
Thanks very much, Brian Johnson. He's currently the interim head of the Department of Journalism at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. He teaches photojournalism and all of its changing and emerging forms here over time. Has been with us many times to talk about cameras and photography. Support for the broadcast today comes from Warden Martin Subaru and Savoy at Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana. A zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910. The program also made possible today with support from the Champaign-Urbana Tenant Union, helping people resolve housing problems for more than 30 years. The Tenant Union
Union is a member of Community Shares of Illinois, a choice for payroll deduction network, on the web at cs-il.org. We also want to thank the people who listen to this station and support it. Very, very important. All the individual listeners and families, folks who have called in and made contributions or maybe gone online. If you've done that, we want to say thanks. If not, now would be a good time. We have a telephone number you can call, not the one for the show, but the one to pledge, 217-244-9455. You can call and make a contribution. We've got a minute here. Martha Deal, one of our producers, is here in studio with me.
And we'd like to thank the people who've called in this morning. Today, we are, as of now, we have 97 people who called in for a total of $12,486 today, a grand total of $47,957. We want to thank you very much. You know, joining together with other people in the community to give us a contribution makes us a better community. We are pleased to bring you programs that are relevant, innovative, and informative, and your generosity makes it possible for us to continue to do that. Without you, we don't function in the same way. Without you, you could be getting national programming and not having the chance to talk to Brian Johnson. So we want to thank you very much, encourage you. If you have not called in yet, please do so. Number's 217-244-9455.
And that's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. More coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of our program, the Afternoon Magazine, Rich Warren, the host of the Midnight Special, will join us. Rich Warren joins us at 1:06 this afternoon. Let's turn our attention to commodity prices as we do every weekday at this time. In Kansas City, December wheat is trading at 517. That's down 7. March, 534, down 5 and a quarter. December wheat in Chicago trading at 503, down 10. March, 524, down 8. December corn, 373 and a half, down 9 and a half. March, 385 and a half, down 9 and a half. May, 394, down 9. July, 401 and three quarters, down 8 and a half. November beans, 979 and a half, down 14 and a half. January, 982.